Welcome to Joy Connection, your journey to well-balanced living podcast series. Please welcome your host, Ralph Weaver.
Hi, I'm Ralph Weaver, and welcome to EWC Joy Connection, Journey to Well-Balanced Living. Thank you for being here. Today's episode is for anyone that has ever had to, or will in the future, have to care for a loved one. Seeing someone you cherish need help in ways they didn't before can often bring up a variety of emotions. We have a special guest who has experience in caregiving, and we hope his story can inspire others in a similar journey. Please welcome our guest on the podcast, Michael Cochran.
Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning to you, Michael. We're so glad to have you here.
Thank you for asking me.
So, Michael, I just would like to start out by asking you, why is caregiving a passion for you?
It's a passion in giving back. Unfortunately, you know, life intervened and I was interjected as a caregiver when my husband, Ron, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's back in 2008. And so that began our journey together and my enlightenment into the caregiving world of what does that really mean?
When you were faced with being a caregiver, did it give you pause? Did you stop and say, can I do this?
Yes. Yeah. It struck terror in my heart because I had no training as a caregiver. I was not in any of the medical professions. I had not chosen to be a caregiver. My careers had been totally different from that. But there I was, you know, the diagnosis was concrete. It was black and white. And I had to like stop and figure out, okay, now where do I go? How do I deal with this? What's my next step?
Now, did anyone provide you with like how-to information when you first became a caregiver?
No, unfortunately, Ralph, I was completely on my own, or I felt that I was completely on my own. I had not experienced firsthand being a caregiver for somebody with dementia. So it was a huge learning curve for me. I don't think that those people like myself who haven't chosen caregiving as a passion in their lives, there's a huge learning curve for us, a huge learning curve.
Now, what was your life like at that time? I know you were working professionally. What was your life, if you could describe how you had to juggle your professional life as well as that of a caregiver?
Okay. All right. Yeah. One of the nice things about, we had a diagnosis fairly early in Ron's disease. And so at the time, Ron was still very high functioning. I could leave him alone. He could still do many, many, daily tasks of living. And so I was able to juggle being a real estate agent along with watching over him in the beginning. As time wore on, it was very evident to me that he could no longer be left alone. And the expense of having people come into our home to sit with him and be with him would be pretty high. So, I juggled it as long as I could. Eventually, I had to make a decision to stop and stay home and be his full-time caregiver.
And how did you stay focused and energized while you were providing care to a loved one?
I had a lot of love. I had a lot of love in my heart. My husband and I had a wonderful relationship. We had a wonderful relationship for 33 years. He was my very best friend and I was his. We got along great. He was my soulmate. And that love, I really attribute to how I was able to hang in there, how I was able to find the energy to continue to be the best caregiver for him that I could as his mental condition deteriorated. And it was sad to watch. I also did try to exercise. I tried to watch our diet. I made sure that we got out, you know, we would walk and do things like that. So it helped me stay focused. And also I had a few friends that would always continue to talk to me, call me and see how I was doing in order to give me a moment to vent, and then I could refocus on what was happening in the day.
And Michael, that was such a powerful statement that you made about just a lot of love and just having that, because I truly believe that's the foundation of just so much that gives you the strength to go on. But I'm sure there were days that you wanted to just give up.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I did. Yeah. I also understood that my husband desperately needed me. He needed me. He needed my help. He needed my guidance. I needed, you know, that I could provide safety to him and protection and love and just oversee his life as his disease progressed. And it was very difficult, especially when I read technical journals and I read blogs and stuff about Alzheimer's and what does that mean and what were people going through and that type of thing. So it was very difficult. There were days I really thought about giving up, but then I thought, no, I can't. He needs me.
And Michael, I'm wondering, where did you turn? You mentioned loved ones that were very supportive of you, but were there any groups that you went to, support groups, or where else did you go for guidance, advice, for help?
Well, the best thing that I ever found, and I would always recommend this highly to anybody who's a caregiver with someone with dementia, is find a caregiver support group. And I found one. It was through the Senior Friendship Center here in Sarasota, Florida, and they have ongoing caregiving support group meetings every single week, either in person or via, you know, Zoom or something like that. You know, get thee to a caregiving support group, because it was invaluable. Just to know, Ralph, that I wasn't alone. I wasn't the only one going through this. And I learned so much from my fellow participants in that support group, because many of them were further along in the spectrum of caring for their loved one with dementia. And so they could look in, you know, in their rearview mirror and say, you know, I would advise somebody to do X and Y, not Z and V, you know, that type of thing. So it was just invaluable to me to find that caregiver support group.
But how would you respond to someone that would say, look, I'm a private person. I don't want to share that with others, that it's no one's business. And so that's a way for them not to seek out a support group. Any guidance there that you would tell them?
I would tell them to stop listening to themselves. You know, this is the time to reach out to others to help you. You cannot do it alone. Absolutely not. Because the stress alone will do you in. It will do you in. You need others to help you. You need to ask for help. And the nice thing, too, about the caregiver support groups are it is totally private. No one, you know, everybody that's in the group always are reminded every single week that we are not to share private information with anybody else outside of the group. And it created a safety harbor, if you will, for us. So you could just, you know, talk about what's bothering you. Talk about how do I get the car keys away from my loved one and that type of thing. And not be afraid to reach out and speak. But for those people that really think they can do it alone, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong. You can't. You need help and you need to reach out for help.
Now, for you, what was the most difficult aspect of caregiving? Was it the aloneness or the sense of helplessness and frustration that you were able to share with your support group? But just those general feelings, what was that all about?
The difficult aspects was I was alone. It sounds terrible, but when Ron was diagnosed and he began to really exhibit symptoms to the outside world that I had already recognized, we were, unfortunately, our friends in the town that I live in, our friends deserted us. They were so uncomfortable with his illness and his new behaviors that all invitations stopped, phone calls stopped. And when I asked for help, none of them would help me. The same thing happened, unfortunately, with Ron's entire family, who we were very, very close with. He comes from a very large family. We were together for so many years. I watched his younger siblings grow up from teenagers, get married, have children, my nephews and nieces and all of that. They all abandoned us because they were so afraid of the disease. Unfortunately, in my husband's family, they have a genetic predisposition for Alzheimer's. His mother had Alzheimer's. Both of her sisters had Alzheimer's, and her brother had Alzheimer's. And now Ron had Alzheimer's, and he was the oldest of five children. So everybody pretty much freaked out and backed away. And whenever I asked any of the family to help me, they refused, unfortunately, because they were afraid and uncomfortable. Well, that wasn't a really good feeling for me, because now I felt like I was really on my own. But you know what? I was up for the challenge because my husband needed me. And so I was sad, but, you know, that's just the way it was. And what I found out too, Ralph, in the long run was I had to forgive them all because they just weren't strong enough to help me. And that wasn't, I mean, it's just the way it was. They just weren't strong enough to help out. And I accepted that and I moved on. I don't have room in my heart for animosity or anything like that anymore.
And Michael, you shared just moving on. And I know that is very difficult after the loss of a loved one. But how have you moved on? And I'm just curious in terms of the work that you're presently doing.
I officially retired. After Rod passed away, I was just a little too tired to go back. But I decided that, you know, I guess the big thing for me, Ralph, was that I'm still alive. You know, my husband was the one that had the disease. My husband is the one that passed away, but I didn't. I'm still here. And I'm joyful in the fact that I am still alive. You know, I'm not a kid anymore. But that's okay. I have a lifetime of experiences, and many of them were sad, but many, many, many of them were really good and joyous. So I still have that love in my heart. I still have my wonderful memories. And I've decided that I'm going to embrace life. I meditate a lot, and my mantra that I use is, today I choose happiness. And I'm just kind of living by that. I have a very strong faith, which was really solidified by the experience that I went through with my husband. There's a joy to being alive and being thankful that I have this body and that I can still do all the things that I can do. I have friends, you know, I've made some new family. So every day is a wonderful gift for me, despite my loss and despite how much I miss my husband.
And Michael, your words are just so inspiring, but I'm curious as to how, after being a caregiver, that you decided in your retirement to help others in terms of providing support to caregivers and teaching about it. So I'm just curious, what made you decide to do that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've got a specific, I was thinking about this about a year ago, I guess it was. When I was going through the ordeal, if you will, of my husband, I still had him home at the time. I had not placed him in a facility as of yet. It was exhausting. He was up and down all times of day and night and confused and lost and everything. So many times, one of the things that I encourage people to do is contact the Alzheimer's Association. They have a helpline that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's manned by volunteers and staff members. So when I would get particularly frustrated or crazy or just insane or back myself into a corner, because Ron had asked me the same question 687 times, you know, I would call them. And after I got off the phone call with the person that answered the phone, the volunteer, once again, because I called them many times over the years, I always felt comforted. I always felt listened to. And they always gave me wonderful advice. You know, they didn't tell me what to do, but they gave me advice. When I got off the phone, the last time I spoke to someone there, I said, you know what? Down the road, when this is all over, I want to do what they're doing. I want to give back and I want to help other people that are going through what I went through So at least they know there's someone else who's been there, who's done it, who lived it, who breathed it, and can give you some advice and just listen and just be there. So that's where it all started for me.
On this journey, Michael, I'm just wondering, are there certain personality traits as you talk with people and as you teach courses on caregiving that you say this person would be an ideal caregiver, or having that difficult conversation with someone to say, no, the challenges faced by providing caregiving services, and it may not be for that person. So tell me about what you see as, is there an ideal type first? I'll ask that question. Personality trait that would be good at providing care to a loved one.
Oh, good question. This is a difficult one, Ralph. I think the personality trait that you have to have is that you have to love the person that you're caring for. You have to love them, and you have to want to be there for them. Nothing prepares you for this. I've had doctors, I've had nurses, medical professionals in my classes. And even with their medical training, they weren't prepared to be a caregiver. So I think it's, but if you have the love for a person, whether it be a father, a mother, a husband, a wife, a partner, you know, a sister, a brother, a child, whatever it is, if you have a love in your heart for them, I think that you can do this. Now, you need to educate yourself. You need to, you know, investigate the disease, whatever's causing, you know, what's whatever's going on. You need to arm yourself with knowledge. And that's when that'll really help you get through this. But I think love is probably it.
And Michael, I would imagine it's having a difficult conversation with yourself, with your family members and loved one when you say, I'm going to provide those caregiving services. But what if you just say, it's too much for me, I can't do this? Have you encountered people that feel that way? They want to do it because they love someone, but when they look at the role and the requirements, it's just too much.
Yes, we do run into that. I have encountered people with like that. I tell them, okay, number one, stop feeling guilty. If you really feel that you can't do this, then stop feeling guilty. But what you do need to do next is you need to help. You need to engage and ask for help from others to provide the care for your loved one that you can't. Because sometimes people physically can't do it. You know, they have their own medical issues. And it's very, very stressful being a caregiver, especially with somebody with dementia. So, you know, just tell them to get over the guilt but ask for help and keep asking for help and seek out the right help for your loved one so that you can back off, as you may need to. But there's no shame in it at all. The shame is if you don't ask for help, you know, and you just kind of grudge through it. Cause then I can't really believe you'd be a very good caregiver, but there's no shame in it.
Well, Michael, earlier you mentioned the Alzheimer's Association where you turned to for help, but so often people may not know where to turn to. So what guidance would you give them there?
Well, in our area, I would tell them to contact the Senior Friendship Center. Senior Friendship Center has a wealth of individuals and capabilities to help direct you, to steer you, to guide you. You know, but talk to neighbors, talk to friends, you know, maybe somebody else you know has been in that situation or they're going through it right now in your neighborhood, in your apartment building, in your condo, wherever. You know, usually you're made aware of it. And you can just, you know, reach out for resources like the Senior Friendship Center. They can guide you. Also, many, many cities and towns have centers for aging that they can reach out to, and they will provide many of the same services to give you guidance on where you're going to go. And even if you talk to the Alzheimer's Association, they can tell you they can give you different things to try to investigate. You can call your hospital, your local hospital, and ask them, you know, I'm in this situation, I'm a caregiver now, help, 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 you know, and they can definitely do that. Speak to your doctor, but I have to qualify that part if your doctor is a geriatric physician. A regular primary care physician who has no real experience with geriatrics probably wouldn't be a whole lot of help. So does that answer your question, I hope?
Oh, yes, it does. And I would like to follow up by saying, are there any federal government programs that you're aware of that for caregivers?
Not that I'm aware of, no, Ralph. Not for caregivers. For the recipients, yes, like the Veterans Administration, and there's other nonprofit agencies that can help provide some funding to help a caregiver bringing in additional help to the home, you know, with a home health care worker or a certified nursing assistant, that type of thing. But I'm not aware personally, and just because I'm a lay person, I'm not aware of any federal programs that are at the caregiver that are really focused on caregivers. One thing right now, Ralph, I live in an area, and when I look at the neighboring counties, I can go at least six or seven counties away from me, which is all the way up the state of Florida, and there's nobody teaching this class but myself and one other individual. We are trying to get the word out there so we can have other people trained to be, trained to teach the class that I teach for caregivers, because it's all about caregivers. But I'm sorry, I don't know of anything federally that's available for the caregivers themselves.
So, Michael, if you could tell us a little bit about your course. I mean, what is the structure? Is it a 3-week or 1 week? Or just tell us a little bit about the course and how it benefits the caregiver.
Yeah, the class is, each session is 2.5 hours long. They are done because we are trying to be good to our caregivers and not take away a lot of their time, because they can't give up a lot of time because they're right in the middle of caregiving. So 6 weeks, one day a week for 2.5 hours. And we talk about everything, the fact that they're not alone, the challenges of caregiving. We identify and help them figure out how we're going to manage caregiving stress, identify the signs and the sources of your stress, everything from positive self-talk. And most importantly, Ralph, we teach them how to do action plans. And these are action plans that are very specific for things that they need to do to help themselves regenerate their spirit, to lift their spirits, you know, like go get a manicure, go get a pedicure, go play golf with a buddy, go out to lunch with a girlfriend, and those type of things. So we have action plans, and we actually make them do an action plan, and we teach them, and we have them create an action plan in all of the classes. We do breathing exercises. We do relaxation exercises. We talk about communication in challenging situations, like having a family meeting, talking to a family and reaching out to a family and saying, I need help. And how do you go about doing that so that you're not coming across like demanding, but you are explaining your situation? We talk about different types of assertive communication. We talk about dealing with anger, dealing with guilt, dealing with depression, you know, and listening to your own emotions and that type of thing. So it's a plethora of topics that we cover over the 6-week period.
No, it sounds like an excellent program, Michael. And when you mentioned getting the families to rally behind and to offer that support, I'm just wondering, are there some practical tips, little things that people can do? Because earlier when you mentioned people run away because they don't know how to deal with it, but are there just some simple things that someone could do to provide some support to that caregiver?
Just listen without judgment. Don't tell them what to do, but just be there as a friend, be there as a loved one. But listen, check in with them frequently, see if they need some help. And if you can, emotionally and mentally, if you can, help them sit with the loved one who is ill, give them a break. Okay. That type of thing. In the early phases, Ron was very docile. I encouraged a neighbor who had offered to take him out to lunch. And the neighbor did a couple of times. And it was very helpful for me because it gave me a break. But, you know, little things like that, a phone call, send a text to say, I'm thinking of you and you need anything. those types of things. But just let people know that, you know, you still matter in their lives, even though they know you're very busy with your caregiving right now. And just, you know, spread the love, I guess.
And the spreading the love is something that, regardless of your financial circumstances, we can all give love. But my follow-up question is, someone that is faced with caring for a loved one, but they have limited funds on a budget, and they may not be able to then call in people to provide, say, cooking services or to help clean the home or other things that would relieve them of some of the responsibilities. What is your message to them? What can they do to just survive and to provide the love and support to their caregiving role?
Yeah. The number one thing that I would recommend, Ralph, is that they ask for help. Ask from help from neighbors, friends, and family. And don't just ask once. Ask multiple times and tell them why you need help. Why you not just say, "Oh, I'm overwhelmed," but, you know, just tell them, "I really need some help. I really need a break." And even though you ask the first time and they say no, or they can't do it for whatever reason, ask them again later on. Don't ever stop asking for help, because you will get it. You will get it. But just don't give up because the first time they said no and you never call them again, you know, that type of thing. But don't give up, because there are people out there that will help you. There's good-hearted, kind people out there everywhere. Who aren't necessarily afraid, and they will take on the challenge. And the earlier you can involve them, the better off you'll be, because they will witness the progression of the disease and it won't be quite as frightening. They'll just say, "Yeah, it's the Alzheimer's, it's the dementia. That's all it is." You know, and they're more used to it. So.
In hindsight, Michael, is there anything that you would have done differently in providing care and love to Ron?
Anything different? Let's see. Would I have done anything different? Well, I kind of had to forgive myself because I yelled at him. I got so frustrated, and that's really something you shouldn't do. It wasn't his fault that he had Alzheimer's, but I did yell at him because he was driving me crazy and I was exhausted. I think in hindsight, what I would have done was I would have placed him sooner in a facility. And even though people look at that expression of you're going to place your loved one somewhere, you have to not look at it that way. You have to look at it from the aspect of, I'm engaging a team of people to help me care for my loved one. And that's what I did. And in hindsight, yeah, just, I would have probably placed him sooner, and I would have maybe brought more people into the house earlier. Because I was in a position where I could. But again, for me, I guess in hindsight, and I might have taken much better care of my diet. You know, because when people have dementia, as time progresses, they lose their sense of taste. And so the only things they can taste as time goes by are very, very, very sweet things or very, very spicy things. And everything else is just like nothing. And so that affected our diet, because I was trying to cater more to his, you know, getting him to eat, that type of thing. So I think I would have, in hindsight, I would have made separate dinners for myself.
Well, and Michael, one of the things that you in that answer was just that the whole topic of guilt. And here you're providing and giving all that you can. But I've just heard from others, too, that sense of guilt can just be overwhelming, that can immobilize you from making the decisions that you know are the right decisions intellectually. But how do you really follow through on them?
I think you have to forgive yourself, Ralph. You have to forgive yourself. We're all human. We make mistakes. You know, when I yelled at my husband, I told him I was sorry. I gave him a hug. I gave him a kiss. You know, I just said, "I'm very, very sorry." And then I had to forgive myself and move on. You know, when I make mistake, I wasn't an Olympian caregiver. You know, but I was a good caregiver. And because I needed to take care of me because I was there for him. You know, he desperately needed me. And I got the message. And but I had to forgive myself, you know, that I wasn't perfect going along.
But Michael, I just commend you for all the love that you have in your heart and what you did for Ron, but also in your work today, what you're doing for others. And because no one would say or say anything negative about you if you decided that you wanted to be on the golf course every day and not help anyone after your journey. Right. So I just commend you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. But it's just, I think we all have to be kind to one another, Ralph. Mm-hmm. As you well know, you know, we have to spread the kindness. The world's a crazy place. And so every day we just need to spread a little more kindness. And well, that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful segue, Michael, too, as we end our discussion. We like to talk about the shift to joy. And you've been touching on so much today that resonates with what we're trying to do with the EWC Joy Connection. And so we'd like to ask you, what brings you joy?
Oh, a lot, many, many things. Again, I'm alive, Ralph. I'm alive. I look for the awe, the A-W-E, in every day. I make a game of it. That brings me joy when I see something. You know, I try to be kind to people. I'm just so blessed. I'm just so blessed. I have friends that love me and care for me, that are always checking in on me. You know, I'm healthy. You know, knock on wood, despite my age, I'm very healthy and I try to take care of myself. But I just try to look for the good in the day, and I try to appreciate my surroundings. And I remember, you know, that I take joy in all that I do have and not what I don't. You know, that's what's really critical for me. So it doesn't matter if it's a sunny day or a rainy day. As long as I wake up, I go, "Ooh, made it. All right. All right. Here we go again," you know, and I get to do what I'd like, which is nice. So, but, you know, just I get another chance to spread a little joy and spread a little love and participate in this beautiful world.
That's wonderful, Michael. So is there anything else you'd like to mention before we wrap up?
Yeah, just to all the caregivers out there in the world, you don't have to do this alone. You don't. There are people that are going to help you, and you just need to ask them. You need to take care of yourself. You need to take care of yourself. It's so important, because if you're not there, what happens to your loved one? You know, what happens to them? So it's, you know, but look for help, seek a caregiver support group, take a class like the one that I teach, you know, but reach out for help. You don't have to do this alone. Don't think that you have to do it alone. And that's especially true, as I must say, for my own gender, in that we are raised not to be caregivers. You know, we think, oh, we can do this on our own. We can do this on our own. No, you can't. You just need to ask for help. So reach out for help, even if it's very hard for you to do. Educate yourself on your loved one's disease as best you can, and understand that your role has changed. You are now a caregiver, as well as being a spouse or, you know, a brother or a sister, a child of elderly parents and all of that. But reach out for help.
My heartfelt thanks to you, Michael Cochran, for a wonderful, wonderful chat. And I'm sure our followers will certainly feel inspired after hearing your story, your words of inspiration, and your journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph.
Hi, and welcome back to EWC Joy Connection, Journey to Well-Balanced Living. This episode is in two parts, interviewing guests who have experience in caregiving. We know how much of a struggle it can be for a loved one So we wanted to create a session geared for families on not only where to begin on this journey, but how to cope with caregiving as well. According to the AARP, today, more than one in five Americans, 21.3%, are caregivers, having provided care to an adult or child with special needs and at some time in the past 12 months. This totals an estimated 53 million adults in the U.S., up from the estimated 43.5 million caregivers in 2015. Our next guest is a licensed clinical social worker, Iris Weichler. Iris has been a medical social worker and patient advocate for 40 years. She was a member of a multidisciplinary treatment team working with patients on a physical medicine and rehabilitation unit. She was also the director of medical social work at a large hospital in the Chicagoland area. Iris has supervised social work students from all the social work schools in the Chicagoland area. Her work has focused on patients with catastrophic illnesses, as well as providing psychological assessments, discharge planning, and counseling for patients and family members in emergency rooms. Iris has done extensive individual family and group counseling, offering therapy and support group to patients and their family members. She used her hospital-based work as the basis for her first book, Patient Power: How to Have a Say During Your Hospital Stay. Iris has written three books and numerous written essays and articles. She has been featured in Forbes magazine, Redbook magazine, Good Housekeeping, Next Avenue, and Mind Body Green. Iris has extensive experience working with seniors in connection with her hospital experience, workshops, and conference presentations. Many of the patients and family members she worked with were facing a major medical crisis as seniors, which added an additional challenging layer to their recovery. Please welcome Iris Weichler.
It's great to be here, Ralph. Thank you for having me.
And Iris, this is just a subject that is close and dear to my heart. And I wanted to ask you, what are the positive aspects of being a caregiver to a loved one?
Well, there are a lot of incredible aspects to it. One of the things that people don't recognize is when you're a caregiver, there's an intimacy that grows from that relationship. And it can be a really wonderful and beautiful thing to watch. You can mend relationships that might have been damaged when you're a caregiver. You can learn a lot about yourself as a caregiver, which is really important. And you can learn to rely on others for help too. And it can bring family members closer together as well. And that can also be a really important aspect of it. I think people sometimes get worried or concerned about caregiving and they hear a lot of the negatives, but they don't focus on the positives. So I'm really glad you asked that question. And also, people aren't aware there's so many services generally around where they are that they can get the help they need.
I know that sometimes people will say, I can do it. And then they really don't have a realistic assessment of what's involved with caregiving. So what are some of the signs that are involved in determining whether or not you would be good at providing that care to a loved one?
Well, I think the thing you need to do is be flexible. And I think for everybody, there comes a point where they need to sort of examine themselves. I think the biggest problem for caregivers is that they feel they can do it. And then when they find that they can't, they don't ask for help. And that's such a huge issue. And what I'm talking about is really caregiver burnout. Over 65% of caregivers are women, and women are notoriously bad at taking care of themselves because they really want to reach out and help people that they love and they care about. And the result of this is they sacrifice their own health and well-being. And that can be a real issue. So it's important that as a caregiver, that you learn to be able to ask for help when you need it and also that you learn to be able to say no when you're asked to do something that you can't do. Those are the two toughest things to do, but those are the two aspects that make you a really good caregiver when you can do those things, because it's really almost impossible for one person to do it all 24 hours a day, every day of the week.
Now, what are the signs that indicate that you need help?
The signs for burnout are these. There are physical signs, and those signs are problems with your stomach, headaches, body aches, and not being able to sleep or wanting to sleep too much. There are behavioral changes. You find that you get more irritable or more angry or more frustrated. And then the emotional ones are huge ones. And with caregiving, some of the things that can happen when you're burned out is that you can get depressed. You can get anxious. You become more angry more quickly, more frustrated, sad. And there's feelings of hopelessness and helplessness that can go along with that if you can't make the person you're caring for better, or you feel that the things that you're doing are not making a difference.
Now, are there support services for people that are dealing with that need help, but they can't recognize it? Are there support services for people?
Yeah, there always are support services if you know where to look. And in your area, there's usually an area on aging office, and that's a good place to start if you don't know what to do. If your loved one has been at a hospital, there's usually a social worker. Like, that's what I did. That was my job. And that's a good place to reach out. People can check with their doctor to find out about programs that are in the area. If someone has a loved one who's very, very ill, hospice services are available. And that's a really great resource. And also, senior centers usually have information where you can go to them and find out what's in your local area. The other thing I want to mention is everyone, regardless of where you are, has someone, and all the services that I mentioned are free. I want to say that. There's a program called it's called Geriatric Care Managers, and those are people that locally are in your area, and they're like me. They're usually social workers or nurses, and they're trained to come in and assess what a person needs and help you find the local services in your area. And they'll hook you up with that geriatric care manager. And that person is available to help you as the caregiver and also to help the person that needs care. And they can come back as little or as often as you need them. So, and that's a particularly valuable service for people who have caregiving responsibilities but aren't local. We're living in a world now where our families are so spread out, and you may not live next door, but you're the person that's got the primary caregiving responsibilities. So to find a geriatric care manager in your area, if you go to aginglifecare.org on your computer and you just put in the zip code of the person that needs the care, you will find people in the area that can help you with that. And that's a wonderful, wonderful resource. It does cost money. The insurance doesn't cover it. So what you need to do is determine exactly what the individual care plan with the geriatric care manager is going to be, and then you can find out about what the cost would be. Part of it depends on the frequency that they come in to and help.
And I would imagine that the information you get from the geriatric care manager, it could then help with discussions with family members in terms of who else can provide support if there is one primary caregiver, how others can provide support.
Yes, absolutely. One of the best things for people to do, families to do, is to take a look at who's going to be on the caregiving team. And it may be that someone's not close, physically close, but maybe they have a lot of information about medical issues, or they know how to read an insurance claim. So maybe that person's role will be to do that. Maybe there's someone geographically close and they can do more of the hands-on care. It's really important to sort of assess what skills are available with family members. And if there aren't family members, maybe there's a neighbor. Maybe there's someone from your local church that might be able to help out. There's a network of places that you can go to find help. And it's just determining who's going to be there and what's available in the way of help. And you have to be flexible, too, because as the needs of the patient changes, you have to kind of look back and see where things are at, what worked, what didn't work, and then go from there.
You mentioned earlier that women are often mainly the primary caregivers. So what advice would you give to someone that's juggling other responsibilities in addition to being the primary caregiver for their loved one, but the family, other obligations or children or career, or what is it that you would recommend that they do as well?
And there's so much of that juggling. When you did the statistics, when you opened, I was thinking post-pandemic, those numbers have gone up beyond 53 million, and most of them are women. But the thing to do is, number one, what we talked about a couple of minutes ago, as a caregiver, be aware of yourself and what you're able to do, and not allow yourself to get to the point that you get burned out. Because if you burn out and you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to be able to take care of the person you're taking care of, and you're not going to be able to take care of your family. You're not going to be able to do your job, and a lot of things will fall, including you'll jeopardize your own health. So the first thing to do is to be realistic about your own self-expectations. Go into it realistically, looking about how you're going to be a mother, how you're going to be a wife, how you're going to be a caregiver, how you're going to function at work, and figure out realistically how that can happen. And most of the time, a person can't do all those things alone. So you need to examine who else can help you with it. You always have to pay attention to your body and to your mind and to your own personal health. If you start noticing changes in any of those areas, you want to be proactive and act quickly. You don't want to ignore that or push that down, because that's going to jeopardize your own physical and emotional and mental health. The other thing is, learn to ask for help when you need it, and to not feel guilty about it. And we can talk about guilt more if you'd like. And the other really important thing is, learn to say no when you're asked to do something that you cannot do. Again, as women are not always good at that. And that's such an important aspect to this. And that's a really important mechanism to use so that you don't find that you burn out. I would say the other thing is to create a care team, so that there, and always incorporate respite care for yourself as a caregiver. And what respite care really means is putting time during the course of the week to spend on yourself, doing things that nourish your body and your spirit and that bring you joy. And so it's important to figure out how to do that. And for people that have a lot of demands where they're pulled in all those different directions that you described, it might be something as simple as getting a book and going in the bathtub and taking a hot bath. It might be doing yoga. It might be taking a walk. It might be whatever brings you joy. And I would also say it's important to identify a person in your life that you can talk honestly with about what's going on, someone that loves you and that you love, and that can sort of be your sounding board, and someone that you can just kind of sit back and relax and talk about how things are going and get support.
And I would like to pick up on that subject of guilt, because I think that can really stop us in many of our actions. If you're trying to do good, but if the guilt keeps piling on. So please share more of your views on that and dealing with that whole subject of guilt that may not only come from, you may feel like you're not doing enough in terms of the care that you're providing to a loved one, but maybe what other people are saying, or just tell me some of the things that you've experienced in your work in dealing with caregivers and the subject of guilt.
Yeah, I think guilt is such an enormous emotion that caregivers experience, because we're human. And when we're in a situation that we want to change and can't, or we can't do more, that has a deep psychological impact on us and is a really tough aspect to deal with. But I'd say the thing to do regarding guilt is to explore the reasons why you feel that guilt. And what I try to do is help people turn that guilt into regret, because guilt is a really strong emotion and it's very harsh thinking about ourselves. Regret is something that you might or might not be able to change. You might, but it's less harsh. And so I would say, in terms of guilt, some of the reasons that people experience guilt is Sometimes they may feel selfish for recognizing their own needs above the person they're caring for, and then they feel guilty about that. They, in spite of everything they do, they can't change the diagnosis or the progression of the illness, so that is another reason for guilt. Sometimes people feel guilty because they're healthy and the person they're taking care of isn't, and that strikes a chord with people too. And I would say, too, guilt also has an impact on your relationship with the person you're taking care of, and it can come out in negative ways and harm the caregiving relationship and also harm other relationships in your life because it spills over into other things. Guilt can turn into anger. It can turn into frustration. It can turn into irritability. So it's really important to be aware of it. And also, you may have guilt for having feelings of anger or resentment towards the person you're caring for. Sometimes you can do everything in your power to help them, and that person will say, you can't do anything right. Or family members who aren't doing anything will criticize you for how you are acting as a caregiver. And so that can trigger people to feel feelings of guilt. And so it's really important to dig a little deeper when those feelings arise and figure out what's exactly causing them.
That brings up another topic in terms of how do you handle, say, a parent or a loved one that's just in denial about needing care?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. And a lot of people struggle with that. And what I would say is one of the biggest mistakes that people make is they do not have the caregiver conversation early enough. They wait until someone's sick and you're in the middle of a crisis and things are just really hard to manage. So for me, we did not have that conversation with my mom, and she died at a very young age. She was in her 50s. And so we learned from that. So my father said that he wanted to have that conversation with me after she died. And that was a huge gift from my father. And what you want to do is you want to come from a place of collaboration. You don't want to come in there and say, this is what's going to happen with you, mom and dad, when you want to come into it saying, I love you. I care about you. I want us all to sit down and talk about what you think when you want to age, as you age in place. Do you want to stay at home? Would you be willing to have people that aren't family help take care of you? What is your visions? Because I want to give you as long a life and as much of a quality as life as possible. And how can we work together to make that happen? Now, they may not jump on that train and say, oh, here, let's talk about it. But, and it sometimes that doesn't happen. But what you've done is you've opened the door. And even if they don't respond to that, just know that that door's open a little bit. And maybe down the road, you can revisit that conversation. But I really think that giving loved ones, especially your aging parents, the message that I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I want to be here for you and come from a place of love makes a huge difference in how things go.
And Iris, that comes across so clearly and lovingly in your book. When I was reading Role Reversal, How to Take Care of Yourself and Your Aging Parents, how you talked about your father was just so touching. And it's such a comprehensive guide for the 45 million people currently taking care of family members who need assistance because of health-related problems. But the fact that you were able to share your personal experience, I think it will definitely help others, as well as your 40 years of expertise as a patient advocate and clinical social worker. So having a book like this, I know, is an invaluable tool on all those topics, like we don't want to talk about estate planning to grief, to building a support network and finding the right care for your aging parent. So tell me, what was that process like in writing the book?
It was, and thank you for your comment about the book, Ralph. I appreciate it. It was a really interesting process because I went to my father and my family and I said, are you okay with doing this? Because it's a very personal story. And my father was not only okay with it, he wanted to contribute to the book. And I didn't see any other books out there that had the voice of the person being cared for and the voice of the caregiver. And so I thought that was really, really important to do that. And I thought it was a wonderful thing, too, that his voice would be there with mine. And what happened was, as I finished the book, but it wasn't published yet, and my father died. And so unfortunately, he never saw the finished product, but it brings me a lot of personal joy to know that his voice is going to live on and that a lot of people are going to get to know him and know the incredible person that he was. I was really lucky to have an amazing dad. And so I love that part of the book. It took a while to write it. And after he died in the middle of writing it, and I had to take some time off. I was grieving and it was really tough to go back to that. So I gave myself about 2 or 3 months just to work through some of that grief before I went back to it. And then knowing that his voice would be there and telling his story would be there helped me to finish the book.
And I'm curious, are there three, say, takeaways that you would like people to have from reading your book?
I would say everyone has a story, and if you take the time to listen to it, that's a wonderful part of caregiving, reminiscing and talking to the person you're caring for. You can learn incredible things, and it can bring you closer together. I would say don't be a caregiver alone, as we talked about earlier. There are more places and people in your life than you might imagine that can help. And I think it's important also to, as I said, have that caregiver conversation early. So it avoids so much pain and so much trauma and so much conflict down the road.
Well, on our podcast, we like to end our discussion with a segment called The Shift to Joy, asking our guests what brings them joy and makes them happy. So Iris, tell us, what do you do to bring you joy into your life?
Well, if I'm extremely lucky, my family brings me a lot of joy. And so I love spending time with them. I'm also an outdoors person. So I just came back from a hiking trip in Virginia. I love the outdoors and I like to spend time there. And I have a mini golden doodle, and I can't tell you how much joy it brings when I see her jump headfirst into a snowbank or roll around in the beach and play tag with the water. It brings me a lot of joy. She's great.
Oh, that's wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our discussion before we wrap up?
I would just say, kind of on the theme that we've been in, as caregivers are incredible people. Don't put too much pressure on yourself, and always, always, always remember to take care of yourself as much as you want to take care of the other person. On Facebook and on Twitter, I put an article to help caregivers or information to help caregivers. And so I just want people to be aware of that if you want to post those sites. It's a great resource for people, and I always want to mention that so people know about it.
No, that's wonderful, because I think, again, if people, the more information that you have, I think some of the issues that we discussed or challenges earlier in the conversation, it could help somebody, and just you're more informed, and it truly makes a difference. So that's
Absolutely. Great.
So every Monday through Friday,
I post a new article, and it's on my Twitter page, which is twitter.com/IrisWeichler. And my Facebook page is www.facebook.com/roleversal1.
That's wonderful. We'll make sure that our listeners have that information. And please don't forget to leave us comments on our social media pages about your thoughts on today's episode. And please share the Joy Connection podcast link to your friends and family, whether you're listening as you drive, walk, work, or even just sitting by the couch, unwinding after a busy day. Thank you for taking the time to embark on the adventure with us. And don't forget to spread a little joy today.